Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, speaking Dhamma, or coming to listen to Dhamma. Everybody here comes for to gain some sort of benefit, and so what we can do with our Dhamma talks is just to give some sort of encouragement or inspiration, and this is what's called Dhamma Pitti. So, encouragement or inspiration. Connection with the Dhamma. The way we use the Dhamma, we can use it in various ways. We can use mindfulness in various ways. So we can use mindfulness in order to be a little bit happier, have a little bit better life, have a mindful cup of tea, and have a better life because of that. Or we can cultivate mindfulness aiming for the deathless, for the Amata Dhamma. So the Dhamma goes far, it goes all the way. The Dhamma can be taken as far as the practitioner wants to take it. So we can have a bit more happiness, we can do that, we can use the Dhamma in that way. Or we can take it further than that, we can take it beyond happiness. Beyond suffering, to the state of letting go and learning how to give up, learning how to relinquish, how to let go. The Dhamma is also leading us towards not just being very passive. Sometimes Buddhists get accused of being overly passive. So the path taught by the Buddha, the path of Dhamma Vinaya, doesn't teach us to be passive, but it's a path of effort, a way of energy. So we actively practice and cultivate ourselves in all sorts of ways. If we just passively wait and hope something happens, then chances are we aren't going to learn how to give up or let go of things. So we need to contemplate, make an effort. Develop barami, dana barami, generosity, kanti barami, patient endurance, and a sense of a willingness to be able to go into things and go through things, a willingness to look at and contemplate things. So, the Dhamma goes all the way to what we call Nibbana or enlightenment. But it's good to recollect that those are just words. So, we really have to contemplate what is the meaning of those things. When we talk about Nibbana or other Dhamma concepts, and we have to really contemplate what really are those things. Because this is just the word Nibbana, this is just Pariyatti Dhamma. When we read these terms and words in the suttas, in the Tipitaka, this is what we call Pariyatti Dhamma. And the root of the Pariyatti Dhamma is the Patiweta Dhamma from the Buddha. The Buddha, sitting under the Bodhi tree in the night of enlightenment, gave rise to what we call the Patiweta Dhamma, which is the Dhamma of liberation and a relinquishing of the final relinquishing of the asava, of the defilements. So that's the Patiweta Dhamma. And then the teaching that the Buddha gives is what we call the Pariyatti Dhamma. When we take that Pariyatti Dhamma and try to put it into practice, that's what we call the Patipatti Dhamma, the practice. So we take the pariyatti, we compare it with our own experience. That's the patipatti. That's what we're... That's why we come to the monastery, is to practice, is to patipat in Thai. Patipatti Dhamma. So the pariyatti Dhamma, this is pointing to the Tipitaka, but also those are the suttas and the text. We have the text, the words on paper, but we also have the real Tipitaka. So the real Tipitaka is in the heart. So that's hallmark of the Thai forest tradition, is this encouragement to read the real Tipitaka. Why don't you read the real Tipitaka, which is your own heart? That's what's really teaching you. So we have the text, the suttas, Majjhima Nikaya with Anguttara Nikaya, Samyutta Nikaya, Dika Nikaya, and so on. We have the Vibhanga and the Chulavaga and the Vinaya Pitaka. We have the Abhidhamma. So these things are, we have great translations from our senior monks like Thanajan Jeff or Bhikkhu Bodhi. So we have that as a resource. But then we have this constant encouragement from the great Kruba Ajahns in the Thai forest tradition to try out to read the real Tipitaka, read the heart, or read nature. That's what it comes from. That's what the Buddha was looking at. The Buddha was looking at nature. The Buddha didn't carry any books around with him. He had his rag robes and his bowl. So before the wandering ascetic Gotama became the Buddha, before he realized Buddhahood, he had his rag robes and his bowl, and investigating truth, investigating nature, investigating the elements, investigating earth, investigating air, investigating water, investigating fire. So nobody told the wandering ascetic Gotama about the truth of these things. Nobody told him that his body was not me, not mine, not self. Eventually, through his investigation of nature, then he realized these things for himself and achieved Buddhahood, achieved awakening, achieved the Patiweta Dhamma, and then once he started turning the Dhammachaka, the wheel of the Dhamma, then he gave rise to the Pariyatti Dhamma that we have today. So, what to say? It's important to give rise to a sense of inspiration. This doesn't necessarily come from talking a lot. It can come from silence. Inspiration can come from listening to nature. But we have to find some way, those are of us who are practicing, we have to find some way to sustain ourselves or nurture ourselves in the practice. So if we're making a long-term commitment to practice, either as a long-term lay practitioner or as a monastic, then to find some way to keep ourselves inspired, some sort of investigation that keeps us going, something that keeps us above a certain threshold of well-being. So the Buddha taught sila, so virtue. This creates like a foundation or a certain threshold, which we won't go below a certain threshold of well-being. So this comes from sila. And then there's also a certain way of living which which protects us, which keeps us from falling into darker states of mind. So this is what we call hiriyotapa, which is sometimes translated as shame and fear of wrongdoing. But also there's been various translations: composure, deportment, a sense of conscientiousness. A sense of hiriyotapa comes from seeing the results of actions. So seeing that if we do something unskillful or unwholesome, that really does bring dukkha to us, that really does bring suffering to ourselves and others. Or that if we do things that are skillful and wholesome, then those give rise to a sense of well-being and happiness. So hiriyotapa as a protector, lokapala, protector of the world. So that we start to see the results of our actions, we start to see that doing things for others is something that gives rise to a sense of well-being and happiness. And then overly focusing on ourselves or on our own practice is something that gives rise to a sense of tension or tightness or stress. And so we have these two types of practice, which is the practice which is focused on oneself, sometimes to the exclusion of others. And then there's the focus on others. And years ago when Lungpar Liam visited here, I remember him teaching a saying in Thai, which I can't remember the Thai now, but it's that when you suffer for the sake of another, then the happiness and well-being that comes back to you is more. So when you suffer for the sake of another, the happiness and well-being that comes to you is more than that suffering. So this is important. This is why people, sometimes parents, will have a sense of great happiness looking after their children. I can't sleep when I want to. I can't do things according to my own schedule of how I would formulate it for myself. But, you know, the child might wake up in the middle of the night, got to be there all hours of the day. So parents, gratitude to parents, not just our own parents, but all parents, reflecting that that's a relinquishment of self or a relinquishment of selfishness. And so if the parents hold it in the right way, not feeling oppressed by it, but in a sense, there's a sense of going outside the comfort zone for the sake of this helpless little baby, this helpless child. There's a certain way things are done in the lineage of Lungpar Cha, which is incredibly beautiful. Lungpar Cha, Bodhinyana Thera. He taught his disciples to have a real sense of not putting oneself up on a pedestal, not advertising oneself or one's own abilities. There's a sense of putting forth great effort in the practice, but to downplay it. In the Tibetan tradition, they call this being a hidden yogi. You could say in Lungpar Cha and all of his disciples who have become great monks, great teachers in their own right, you could say it's a lineage of hidden yogis. It's not a tradition in the Lungpar Cha lineage of speaking about one's own attainments. There's not a tradition of really praising oneself. There's not a tradition of going around telling everyone how great you are in the Lungpar Cha tradition. This is incredibly beautiful. Sometimes, as this tradition comes to the West and starts growing up in the West, you might think, oh, these guys are kind of, you know, boring or don't really have anything special. We want to hear some high Dhamma. We want to hear some the path to arhantship and all this. And now here we are talking about, you know, breathing in and out naturally and just seeing how that feels in the body, or just a simple contemplation of the elements. But this is real earth Dhamma. This is forest Dhamma. You know, breathing in and out naturally. Contemplating the elements, contemplating the body as not self. Real emphasis on mindfulness and non-distraction. Once the mind stops getting distracted so much, that's a good sign. Once we start being able to have mindfulness at the fore at all times, and it really is like the mindfulness is in front of us, that really is the experience of it. Mindfulness at the fore. And so if we start daydreaming or say, like, what is he talking about? What was he talking about 1 minute ago? I can't remember. The mind was sort of daydreaming. So the mind starts to think. Those thoughts turn into daydreams. In Thai, they say the word for daydreaming is jai loi, which is like the mind just sort of floats away. So this is grounding Dhamma. This is earth Dhamma. Non-distraction Dhamma. This Dhamma is for one who is not distracted, not for one who is distracted. Forest Dhamma. This is the Dhamma of contemplation of the body. Body is just earth, water, fire, and air. And so earth element, it's like you can contemplate the body as earth element. There's solidity in the body. The body is built up out of food. Food is earth element. So we take earth element in, and certain parts of that earth element the body can use, certain parts it needs to excrete and get rid of in order to keep living. And there's an unclean aspect of that earth element that we call our body. So we might think, like, our blanket or our robe or something falls on the ground, we might think, oh, it's dirty. Our robe drags in the ground, we might think, oh, the robe got dirty. But it's, one can contemplate, actually, the robe is more soiled by coming into contact with the body than it is than coming into contact with the dirt and the ground. Our robe can lay on the ground and it doesn't start to smell. But wrapped around the body, if we don't wash it once a week, and if we don't wash it well, then it has a smell to it, which is repellent, and people will notice, people will be repelled. We might not notice because it's our own smell and we get used to it, but then others might notice and be repelled by that. So this is the contemplation of earth element, the different aspects of earth element, which gives rise to a sense of dispassion and a cooling down of the mind in regard to the body. The body is just earth element. Other bodies are just earth element. We don't have to think of them as extremely beautiful or extremely repulsive, but just that neutral, just earth element. And just seeing the true nature of things, like the Buddha investigating nature, How is it really? Let's dive into this. How is it really? Not how is craving saying it is, or how it wants to be, or not trying to make it conform with our craving and clinging, but just how is it in nature? What is its true nature? And then the earth, the planet, holding us up, so it's solid, and we're standing on that earth element. Bodies of ourselves, bodies of others, or just earth element. When someone criticizes us, it's just one lump of earth criticizing another lump of earth. So, like, somebody might criticize us for our personality, for example. We'll take that as an example. So we can use our investigation of nature to keep our equanimity in the face of that by contemplating that, well, this lump of earth element is shaped one way, and that lump of earth element is criticizing this lump of earth element because it's shaped another way. So which one has the right shape? This is all something that just comes from ignorance and attachment. So this is something very small. Our likes and dislikes are something very small, very insignificant. Our views and opinions are something very small. Our likes and dislikes, our views and opinions, it might seem like the whole world to us, might seem big to us, but in the big scheme of things, they're very small. They're very individual, connected with self. Our likes and dislikes are just something connected with that little tiny point, that me. And for all the different me's all around, there, it's different. So then when we talk about the Dhamma and the transcending of one's likes and dislikes, the transcending of a sense of me or a sense of mine, so then that becomes something very big, very expansive, all-inclusive. There's this one little lump of earth element right here with its likes and dislikes. That's just something that just exists right here at this one little point. But then the Dhamma, or the sense of freedom, comes from that. That's very expansive, that includes everybody. So learning how to call into question the likes and dislikes. This is the Patipatti Dhamma, the path of practice. So water element, blood in the body, is like the body's water element. We need to drink water. We need to have water around us for life. So without water, then the life ends pretty quickly. So water element. So even people who aren't practicing know this. California's in a drought right now. People are trying to conserve water. There also might be fear that water's going to run out. What do we do when the water runs out? The water is what sustains us, sustains our life. Earth element or food sustains us as well, but we can go a little bit longer without eating earth element. So we need to ingest that water element constantly to stay alive. The blood is always renewing itself, always taking in new water element. And old blood is always being excreted from our body. If we don't have enough water element, we get parched, we get dried out, desiccated. Anybody who's ever tried to do a water fast or a no water fast, a complete fast with even no water, 1 or 2 days is pretty difficult. I remember trying to go just 24 hours without water at Dao Dum in Thailand. And so I had fasted before. Yeah, I'd gone 10 days fasting before, but never had gone without water. And so when you fast without food, the body gets a bit skinnier, a bit thinner. But then when you go without water, the whole body sucks in. It really, it's a different experience. It's really amazing, really interesting. And then there's the air element. This is even more important than the water element. Just the air that we breathe. And we're living in a sea of air. We're like airfish. We're living in a sea of air. We rely on oxygen in the air. We can't go out into space, we would die. There's no air element there. So I like to think of it as we're actually swimming in air, and the air is a sort of nutriment for us, a sort of food. We don't take in breath, can only go not more than 10 minutes. Most people not more than 5 minutes. So we're always taking in air. Air goes in to the lungs and is absorbed into the blood immediately, oxygenating the blood. Every time the blood courses through the entire body, then it's renewed with fresh oxygen, and we're breathing out the carbon dioxide, so that waste product is being breathed out. If the air isn't clean, we can feel it. And feel it in the whole body. It's one of the perks of living at a Biagiri, just fresh, clean air. Not living close to the highway. So breathing in, you can sense, you can feel the wind going in. And then if you become attuned to the more subtle sensations, then you start to sense the oxygen getting renewed with that, the blood getting renewed with that fresh oxygen. So with each in-breath, the breath isn't just ending at the lungs, but the oxygen is going straight into the blood and the whole body. So the Buddha talks about, he goes from noticing the state of your breath, whether it's long or short, he goes straight into experiencing the whole body. Then there's fire element, warmth, so the temperature. The body is a very, very small window. The body has to be a certain temperature in order to survive. So it's dependent on this fire element. Fire is what digests. Fire is what consumes and changes things into something useful. So fire has all sorts of, you could say, almost magical abilities to change things into something else. Has the ability to digest food and change it into something the body can use, break it down. When you burn something in a fire, you burn wood in a fire, it changes the wood into something else. It changes it into ash and charcoal. And part of that goes up into the air, becomes air element, gas, smoke. Fire is interesting. You can never have a still piece of fire. Fire is always moving very fast. You can't take a flame and just have a still flame. It's always consuming some sort of fuel. Whereas you can have a lake of water, just the water is just sitting there in a large depression of earth. But you can't do that with fire. Fire has its own properties. So that's how the Buddha defined these elements. They all have very distinct properties. Like you have a flame of fire, it's consuming fuel. So you think of like upadana, like the fuel of craving, or the engine that keeps the wheel of samsara running, is a type of fire, is upadana. You take away that fuel, you can't have a fire. The fire can't just exist on its own. And the fire is like consciousness, so consciousness always has to land somewhere, and that's keeping that engine of birth and death, suffering, happiness, and so on. The wheel of samsara, the bhava chaka, that fuel and the fire, upadana, and then the fire of consciousness alighting on that fuel and burning away. And so that contemplation of fire can't burn without fuel. But we work really hard. We work really hard to keep adding fuel to that fire. Because something in us is telling us that without that fuel, that's death. We'll be annihilated. But we don't know. We've never tried it. We've never engaged in the Patipatti Dhamma to the point of the Pativeda Dhamma. So we don't know. We have to acknowledge that we don't know. So it's an adventure. We're going into uncharted territory. So not only can we contemplate the four elements as not self, but also we can cultivate a sense of gratitude for the elements, that they're available to us and that they're keeping our life going on every single level. Every one of the elements, earth, water, air, and fire, they're always keeping us alive. So we have this precious opportunity to practice, to come in contact with the Dhamma. Even the fire element, the sun is just giving us nourishment. The sun gives us vitamin D, keeps us warm, keeps the earth warm, keeps us within that very tiny window, that zone that we can sustain our lives. So it's very precious, but it's also very fragile, very breakable. Like the Buddha said, the causes of life are few, the causes of death are many. And so we have to take this opportunity while we can to practice. Cultivating a sense of gratitude is also really important. So not only gratitude for the elements, but also gratitude for just the tradition that we're a part of, the opportunity that we have. Gratitude to teachers, gratitude to Lumpur Cha, and so on. Just the very precious gems that we've been given. It's really the style of practice at Wat Bapong is just really interesting. If you see like these senior disciples of Lumpur Cha, or even the up-and-coming senior disciples of Lumpur Liam who live at Wat Bapong. Just really, really, I can't stress it enough, a really strong sense of not just holding oneself in a way that is better than others. There's really a sense of really encouraging each other and a sense of camaraderie, but there's not a sense of individuals trying to one-up each other, or you know, certain people might have abilities that stand out, but they're not holding it in a way that is a sense of, you know, I'm better than you are, or a sense of just wanting people to see and hear how great you are. There's not that energy there, so it's just a really gratitude for that kind of example. And it really comes from developing the heart. You can't just sort of fake that way of being. It really has to come from cultivation of the way of heart. If we're practicing, then our practice is going to express ourselves in our every activity. Everything we do, bowing, our practice is going to express itself in how we bow. So we don't have to actually talk to somebody to know how their practice is going. Just just watch how they bow and pay respects, and you'll get a sense for the sort of devotion they feel for the Triple Gem. Or just how someone conducts themselves during a work project. All of these activities are an expression of our meditation practice. Every activity we do is a test to see how our samadhi is going. So one test to know whether one has samadhi or not is how often does one get irritated and angry? So if that's quite often, one could say the samadhi is not quite strong yet. But if other people's actions don't irritate or anger us, then that's a good sign. The samadhi is getting stronger. It's not necessarily that if we feel bliss or happiness or the mind seems very bright in meditation, it's not necessarily the case that we have strong samadhi. We might have incredible brightness and bliss during our meditation, but then the moment we get up, that one person that always does that did that again, and suddenly irritated, angry, mind goes dark pretty quickly. So the samadhi, maybe it was there, but it's not so stable yet, or that it's not coupled with wisdom. Lumbar Cha said that samadhi without wisdom is like having a candle but no flame. But then having wisdom without samadhi is like having a match but no candle. So you have to have both the candle and the match. You take the flame of wisdom and light the candle of samadhi. And then things are light for quite a while, as long as that candle lasts. The stronger our samadhi is, the more wax there is there, the more candle there is, longer it'll burn for. So maybe we could think of the practice that way, as just wax, just building up wax, just collecting things together very slowly, very, very methodically building up. If we get distracted, the wax is just going to be all over the place. So we have to collect, we have to use sati, we have to use mindfulness, collect things together. It's good to think of mindfulness just at the fore. There's a way, there's a method that one can know if one is distracted or not. And I know from experience, from being just someone who is prone to distraction. So like in the early days at Abhayagiri, you know, be sitting in the morning work meeting, and you know, my mind would be turning over some sort of irritation or thinking and proliferating about something. And then suddenly, say, Ajahn Amaro would turn and say, "Nyanako, what do you think about that?" And of course I wouldn't respond because I was distracted. So if somebody says your name or talks to you and you have a delay before the response, then that shows that the mind is distracted. So that's a good way to know. So it's like, "Nyanako, hello, are you there? Oh, what was I just thinking about?" But now that doesn't happen so much. It's interesting to see that progression. There might be little blips here and there, little thoughts occurring in the mind, but doesn't happen nearly as much. So even though I don't consider myself as someone who has good samadhi or very much wisdom, I say, "Oh, well, I'm less distracted. Maybe that's at least something." It actually almost never happens now. If we're in the morning work meeting and the work monk or Ajahn Pasano turns to say something to me, it's just right there. There's no delay. And that just comes from training, the various ways of training we have in the Thai forest tradition, where we have to be present. When we're just sitting with our eyes closed, it's up to us. Only we know if we're present or not. But if we have to be doing things like attending to the Ajahns or being an Upatak, We've got to be right there, present. This is another side benefit of focusing on the benefit of another rather than the benefit of oneself, is that we learn how to not be so distracted. Distraction gives rise to all sorts of hindrances. It gives rise to all five hindrances. It gives rise to sensual desire, gives rise to ill will and aversion, gives rise to sloth and torpor. I remember trying to investigate, what is this sloth and torpor? And one can really see that it starts through distraction. The mind starts on a train of thought, like if I'm really tired during morning puja, if I'm going to start nodding, it always starts with a train of thought, and then the mind gets off the meditation object, stops focusing on the breath, and gets into some daydream, and then the nodding starts. Every time, you can see that it starts from that kind of thinking and proliferating. So we really have to start contemplating. The Buddha said that the ending of sankharas is vipassamo sukho, is the highest happiness. We do this chant at funeral ceremonies. Anicca vata sankhara upadavaya damino upajitava nirujanti tesang vipassamo sukho. That's the ending of fabrications, ending of sankharas is the highest happiness. That doesn't mean death. That doesn't mean death is the highest happiness. That means the ending of mental fabrications is the highest happiness. So we do that at funerals, but it's not a recollection that... It's not that that person that just died has the highest happiness because they're dead now. It's who knows what's happened to their citta. But it's a recollection that ending, it's a recollection ending on cessation, nirodha. It's a recollection of change, anicca vata sankhara. All conditioned things are impermanent. So everything's changing, everything's inconstant, uncertain. The four elements are always changing, inconstant, uncertain. And so on. Our life situation is changing, inconstant, uncertain. When the time of death comes, where is our life gone? Life just has gone by like a flash of lightning. So our situation, whatever living situation we're in right now, might seem stable and secure. Really, it's changing all the time. So if we investigate anicca in this way, really the practice can become a lot of fun. Sometimes we think of our life as like we were infants and then there was childhood and teenagers and we grew up and there was all these major changes, but now as adults things are sort of stagnating, just the same. But really, between birth and death, things are always changing in the same ways between childhood and teenagers and adults. Those are just designations. So as adults, our body and our whole life, everything is changing just as fast as it ever was. But it's a bit more hidden. So it's good just to mull over and think of Dhamma in various ways to give ourselves a sense of encouragement and a sense of inspiration, and just to know that it goes all the way if we're willing to take it that far. It goes as far as we want to take it. If we're not ready for relinquishment, that's fine. We can take it to a sense of happiness and contentment in our life. But then when suffering comes along, it's good just to remember anicca vata sankhara, all conditioned things are uncertain. And that suffering can spur us on to want to take the Dhamma even further than we took it before. Because having a mindful cup of tea might do something for us, but how far is that actually going to take us? So really taking it beyond, keep contemplating, keep developing. So those are some ramblings this evening. I'll leave it there.
Om Namah Shivaya. Om Namah Shivaya. Om Namah Shivaya.